It was the ultimate weapon of its time, and it enabled the building of empires and the conquests of great swathes of territory in North Africa and the Middle East. It was the chariot, and it was the result of a long period of technological innovation, and recent study has shown that it's even more brilliant than it appeared in its later phases. My guest is Professor Emeritus of Engineering Physics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He is Bela Sandor, and he has done considerable study of these chariots from the standpoint of engineering physics and has become, I gather, quite the admirer of the technology. Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you, Norman.
We're going back as far as 3,500 years for what, as it turns out, was really quite a sophisticated way of creating speed.
Actually, well over 3,500 really? Years, but some great things broke toward betterment about 3,500 years ago.
And had seen some of these Egyptian chariots, of which I gather there are at least several examples, thanks to some tombs, and kind of passed by them without giving a lot of notice. But then on a second look, again, as an engineer, you found some remarkable things about these vehicles.
That's exactly true. Of course, I was interested in chariots since Ben-Hur in 1959. But that was something else. The race in that film is still considered perhaps the most exciting, most spectacular vehicle race in cinema history. So that is still in everybody's mind, and that's what almost everybody thinks about when the word chariot is mentioned. But It goes well beyond that, because that chariot in that film is actually not very accurate of anything. But we can get to that later.
Yeah, I think you mentioned that somewhere in your writings, which are copious, that that chariot that Charlton Heston was driving would have come in last probably in that race, given the way it was built.
Well, not in the film, of course.
No.
Not in the film. But if I put together kind of a virtual race of several distinct vehicles and put this virtual vehicle into that race by Charlton Heston, I think he would come in last because it was just too big and too heavy, and it was not a dedicated racing machine at all. So I would say that that film in the chariot aspect of it was probably 90-95% inaccurate.
Now, do you have a sense as to why the chariot was devised in the first place? Because we have this long history of racing, but we also have this ultimate weapon, the chariot.
Well, the history of vehicles, of wheels, in fact, goes back a very long way. And if you want, I could even explain how the wheel was invented, but that's my opinion. In any case, there was in the Middle East, there are some models, not full-scale vehicles available anymore. But there are some very small toys, essentially toy models, that indicate what these might have looked like. So, for example, if you have kind of a log and you put four wheels on it or two wheels on it, actually two wheels would define a chariot, not four wheels. So if you put wheels on this log and somebody kind of straddles it, that is the precursor of the real chariot. And it's called a straddle car, actually. And there are similar things, and that kind of thing would not be used for racing particularly, but like maybe dragging a log, another log, or something like that.
Getting back to the invention of the wheel, and you can go as far as you want with this, it would have to take place, would it not, in a certain kind of terrain? In other words, it's not likely to happen in the mountains.
That's right. A fairly large
expanse of fairly level terrain for a wheel to be practical.
The best terrain for chariots is a relatively flat or mildly hilly place, not the Andes or the Alps.
And so they developed very early on both in Egypt and other parts of the Middle East?
Oh, yes. The exact location is not terribly clear. There could have been some from southern Siberia. There are tomb findings that indicate that there may have been some very early interesting vehicles. Also in Anatolia, Turkey, essentially. So the Hittites, for example, were very instrumental, and they preceded the Egyptians somewhat.
And competed
Hittites,
with them, too.
Yeah. They competed, but I think what happened was that the Hittites kind of made some major inventions, but the Egyptians have really cleaned their clock.
And so at what point do we have a sense at what point the chariot was actually used large-scale in combat?
Well, probably close to 4,000 years ago.
Really?
Maybe a little bit less. For example, in the Bible, there's a mention of Joseph riding in a chariot. So my best estimate of that would be about 1700 B.C., so you add 2,000 years to that. So we're talking about whether they used it in war or not is uncertain.
Do we have, though, in, say, the Egyptian art, hieroglyphics, et cetera, which seems to be all over Egypt the more you look? It seems like the more there is, a lot of it, of course, richly illustrated, images of chariots, and if so, how detailed?
Well, they are concentrated in a time period, though, so not as far back as 4,000 years ago, but starting in the time of Tutankhamun's grandfather, say, and great-grandfather, around that time, there were already some battle issues, and also some very, very nice descriptions of prestige chariots, like the king appears, you know, like blazing gold, you know. But it can be a very shocking psychological factor, too. If you think of people who have never seen a wheel, I mean, at that time, there were a lot of people in Egypt and around the world who have never, ever seen a wheel. So now all of a sudden, imagine yourself, you are maybe a peasant boy getting ready for battle because you are exhorted to grab your weapons and go to it. And all of a sudden, there's just several. It doesn't have to be thousands, although eventually there were. But sometimes maybe in the beginning, just a few, maybe 100, very fast machines. The noise is thunderous. The horses are galloping. They're shouting. There's dust all over the place, blowing. So you are going to drop your weapons and run.
Well, it's hard to outrun a horse.
Now that kind of battle situation only lasted maybe a couple hundred years. I mean, eventually it wears out, and the idea is not valid anymore. People develop counter tactics and strategies. So eventually it was lost. And then later on, it's obvious the Romans had chariots, but they relied on infantry, a heavy, totally organized infantry. So that was a difference.
The chariots were popular, obviously, as we've said, as racing vehicles among the Romans,
right,
but not so much for combat.
Back one more. So I would say that perhaps the height of chariot warfare in Egypt was at the time of Ramses II, perhaps, Armageddon and the Battle of Megiddo, where the word Armageddon comes from. So that's the kind of situation. So about the 13th century B.C., I would say, was probably the real peak. When there were, in a particular battle, there might have been 1,000 or 2,000 chariots on either side.
That's mind-boggling.
So that's mind-boggling, and that's true. So it's kind of similar to the World War II tank battles.
Yeah, that's
when
right.
There would be 2,000 or 3,000 or 4,000 tanks in Russia, for example. So that would be analogous.
So from a combat standpoint, the chariot would typically hold, I mean, somebody would have to drive the chariot. And then somebody else, I assume, would be an archer who would be attacking from this chariot. Is that
right? Right. Well, there's a lot of very interesting situations. Later on, around 600 BC or so, the Assyrians had very heavy chariots, almost like tanks or trucks, you know, very heavy wheels and so on. That would hold maybe 4 or 5 people. But that was kind of rare. The Egyptians preferred 2 people on the vehicle, and the Hittites had maybe 3 or 4. But there is some fascinating images of just one person driving and shooting and fighting with hand weapons at the same time. And I will demonstrate that to you if you're interested in that anytime.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, if there's a way to do it now, that's fine. Otherwise, we'll...
Okay, so one of the first instances of that is from Tut's tomb. There's a 2-foot-long box. It's fantastic. It's called the Painted Box. It's like miniature painting all over this, and it shows several images of Tut on the chariot with the reins around his waist, and I can show you this.
Mm-hmm.
So I have here a pencil. This
right.
pencil represents a bit for the horse's mouth.
Mm-hmm.
Then from the two ends of this pencil, I have a clothesline that comes back. Now, I cannot demonstrate this. It's not visually interesting at the moment because we are both sitting down. But with people walking around, one can put these reins around the waist.
Right.
And then you can control through the bit.
Yes.
By either pulling on the reins with your back. You know, you lean
sure,
back
yes.
against the rein
yeah.
so you can slow the horses
mm-hmm.
or release them and verbally encourage the horses to accelerate. So just by your waist, you can brake and accelerate. Now, if you're really good, after several hours of practice every day, then you could actually twist your waist.
Oh, for a right turn,
and
left
for
turn.
Turning right uh-huh. or left. So a really good warrior pharaoh. I mean, this is not for the average guy, but a great warrior pharaoh. Tut was not great, but he was displayed like that.
Sure.
But Ramses II was.
Oh, was he a warrior?
Yes, he was a warrior pharaoh of substance. So a person like that could actually drive the horses, maneuver the chariot, even in battle. And the pictures show battles. You know, there's several of these images. Ramses also. In battle, shooting arrows and hacking people with an axe or a sword, and at the same time just driving through. Now, I think that this can be done, but personally, I believe that this is more like a war games sort of thing, where they would demonstrate their skill.
Uh-huh.
And we can come back to that later in some other context, because the war games concept is very significant. So they would do this in war, but a war game, but in a real war, I think they would prefer to have a driver and then they do the shooting.
And these are typically teams of how many horses?
2. Every time you have more, several things happen. The average power decreases if you have more, because obviously the king would have the two best horses in the world.
Right.
Okay. As soon as you add two more horses, they are not as good as the first two. So then the average will be less than the best, okay? Besides, they're more difficult to control.
Sure.
And of course, they take up more space, you know, so that the space for maneuvering is reduced.
So two is the optimum number.
So I would say two is the optimum number, yeah.
And
now, in racing, it's different. The Romans used very often four, and occasionally the Greeks also, sometimes ten. You know, the people fool around.
Well, speaking of fooling around, I want to get into the developments, the technological innovations that made these Egyptian chariots in particular so brilliant. And we'll do that in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Professor Emeritus of Engineering Physics, Bela Sandor, and we're looking at this fascinating technological innovation called the chariot, which really did affect the way war was conducted and also, in a lot of ways, war games, the way they were conducted, and sports also, when you talk about chariot races. As far as actual complete specimens of these chariots from second millennium BC, what do we have for actual specimens?
The best set is what I call the Tut class. The Tut class consists of eight complete chariots. These are existing in museums, six of them in Egypt. No, seven in Egypt and one in Florence. But six of them in Egypt came from Tut's tomb itself.
Wow, what a trove. And that's not until 1922.
Yes, 1922. And they were in kit form, so they had to be restored. But now they look as good as ready to be driven out of the museum.
And
every one of them.
What did we discover from that discovery of those seven chariots?
Well, they have a tremendous design optimization evident to an engineer who is looking carefully. Now, even myself, I was not careful enough when I first saw them, and I could just walk past them because they were just primitive looking. But that's far from the fact. They are actually very sophisticated. In fact, I would say that, and they have such different concepts sometimes as to how to do things that no modern engineer, in my opinion, could possibly duplicate it on his own or her own. Now, they could look at it and duplicate it, but they would not on their own have come up with the same kind of design. The other question is, could a modern engineer do better than these ancients, say, 3,500 years ago? And I would say no. I have challenged hundreds of world-class automotive and aerospace engineers and say, okay, can you use your supercomputers and all of your formulas, but limit it to the ancient materials? Do you think you can improve on that design by more than, say, about 10%? Not a one is willing to take up a bet.
Well, what were some of these innovations? Let's start with, I suppose, the most obvious, the wheels.
Well, let me first mention something else. You know, in cars, an outside mirror, a rearview mirror, did not come into play until about the 1920s or so. And the Tut chariot had, some of them had rearview mirrors.
Really?
Yes. They had, I have in my hand now a hand magnifier, which is essentially a large lentil shape, and you can look through it, but you can also see a reflection in it. So if this were made out of wood and, say, 10 inches in diameter, like on the Tut chariots, and you cover it with a gold leaf, it is a convex rearview mirror. And this was 3,300 years ago or more.
And so some of these King Tut chariots had rearview mirrors.
That's right. That's right. So, okay, so talking about the wheels. The wheels are actually a wheel to be designed perfectly is almost impossible because there's so many conflicting requirements. You have to make it light. You have to make it strong.
You have to make it round.
You have to make it round. You have to make it not sink in soft sand. So a larger wheel is better than a smaller wheel, but the larger wheel is heavier already.
It's going to be slower.
And slower. So you cannot balance all of these in a single wheel. It's just not possible. It's the same as you cannot buy a perfect car, you know, for every purpose, you know, for
sure.
Highway travel and city parking, just like that. So the ancients had this problem, but I think they have managed to optimize it just about perfectly for the given constraints. So they made it a lightweight wheel. It has a good acceleration capability. And that involves not only light weight, but how do you distribute the weight? So that's crucial. Actually, it's strange because you need a lot of weight on the outer rim so that the rim doesn't bend as it rotates and create a wheel bounce.
Sure.
Or even on a smooth road, if the wheel was soft on the outside, it would bounce. We're not talking about pneumatic tires, of course, but we are talking about mostly wood. You know, the ancient chariot was wood, glue, leather, and rawhide.
It's hard to believe, isn't it, that you could get something going that fast.
So they managed to make the rim strong enough. The spokes don't have to be strong on the outer part, but they have to be very strong near the hub, because that's where the bending is most severe in a turning situation. So you have to make the hub area very strong. So they created spokes that are just astonishing. If you look at it more closely, you find that they have tapered sections. They're thick near the hub and thin near the rim. They are elliptical in cross-section to boot, which is also very good for lighter weight but high resistance to bending sideways. So the elliptical cross-section is crucial. The other one is that most of the other spokes are single sticks, you know, like my pencil.
Sure, here. Yeah, that so would be single your sticks. Inclination.
Well, the ancient Egyptian wheels were V-shaped. So if you take your index finger and middle finger and spread them out as far as possible and make a V.
With a spoke like that.
That was an individual spoke. And then they attach another individual
spoke
V
to
next
that v.
to it and make six of these Vs to make a six-spoke wheel.
That's counterintuitive. But
it is totally counterintuitive, and no modern engineer would have come up with this idea. But it has a number of special advantages to this. So it's a tremendous design. But it's expensive. And we still do not know for sure how they were always made, because there's about five or six different ways of making a V-shaped piece of wood. But the worst one would be to try to cut it out with a saw from a single piece of board, because that would be weak in some directions and not weak in others. So you want to make it strong in the axial direction, in the center line of the spoke.
So these chariots from King Tut's tomb, do you have the sense that they were purely for ceremonial purposes, or were they more for practical, you know, even combat purposes?
I would say that mostly they were used for ceremonial purposes, depending on the appointments. You know, the same machine can be improved to the king's satisfaction by a little bit of gold leaf and so on, but it's still the same design, basically. So it's like taking a Chevy frame and make it into a Cadillac.
Some things never change, do they?
They were mostly used for ceremonial if they were shiny, or they were used for hunting. There's some images of them being used for hunting, to run down some animal. And they were used for sport, I'm sure. There's no evidence of that really from Egypt, but I am certain, because the machines are perfect for racing. So why would you have a machine that is good for racing and never race it?
Yeah, and it's such a natural inclination.
It's
anyway.
A natural inclination of humans to race a fast-looking machine. So I'm sure that they raced it in informal fashion around the palace grounds and so on.
What about...
And in war, a little bit in war.
But what about the necessary give and take? I mean, did they have the equivalent of shock absorbers for these chariots? I mean, because we're talking about a wooden rim on a hard surface.
Okay. Until I came around, if I may brag, until I came around, most archaeologists said that, and other people thought as well, that these ancient chariots had no springs and no shocks, no shock absorbers. But this is silly, because wood is a natural spring. Just think of a fishing pole or an old-fashioned wooden diving board. Wood can be made into an actually very flexible spring.
Right.
But every solid material is a spring somewhat. You know, the only question is how much of a spring. So the chariots, when I first started looking at them, one of the first things I realized, not only that they have some springs, but that they're full of springs. Everything is a spring in a chariot. It's so light and everything can flex. So I'm not just looking at the chariot as a chunk of machine that is rigid. No, it can flex, and it's very important that it can flex. Now, for shock absorbing, there are many ways of doing that, but the ancients had a very, very simple solution. They used... Can you hear this?
Mm-hmm.
What do you think I have in my hands?
Well, it looks like rawhide.
It's rawhide. It's dark chewies. you can buy these in virtually any grocery store. It's flat pieces of about 2-inch wide, inch and a half, 2-inch wide, and 6-inch long strips of rawhide. When it's dry, it's like stone.
Yeah, it's very strong.
It's very strong, mm-hmm. and when it's rawhide, mm-hmm. then it's like a wet noodle, and you can apply it, and you can put it around the joint, for example. So you put it around the joint and let it dry. When it dries, it does what a python would do, and now I have a little baby python in my hand. So if you wrap it around something as a rawhide, and then the python is starting to constrict, that's what rawhide does. So it constricts, and it creates an incredibly strong joint. But at the same time, if something inside wants to move a little, it can still allow that. It would squeak, of course, but the squeak would be a sign of actually good energy absorption and shock absorption. So when we made some chariots for the Nova film, they were squeaky. And people thought that was a little bit poor. And I thought, hey, that was the sign of a perfect design. Because in your car, you don't want squeakiness, but in the chariot, you do.
Well, in these chariot races that we've seen on film in Ben-Hur or wherever else, we inevitably see, you know, chariots flipping over and drivers getting spilled out and that kind of thing. So how stable were these chariots?
Well, most chariots were actually incredibly stable. In fact, I would say that there's a natural built-in anti-roll system. as long as the horses are running straight and the horses are not tumbling into a ditch, through the yoke over the horses' necks and through the pole, it applies a natural stabilization effect. So the horses' necks are doing the stabilization of the axle. Now, it can bounce a little. It can twist a little bit up and down. It can roll a little bit, but it would not roll over. It would not, absolutely not roll over. It is kind of impossible. Now, in the Ben-Hur film, there are chariots that are rolling over. So what gives?
Yeah.
Well, what gives is that the Hollywood engineers were brilliant. For some of their chariots, they did not want rolling over, like for the hero. Mm-hmm. You don't want the hero to even accidentally roll over. But the villains, any villain could roll over. In fact, you would want to encourage that villain to roll over. So what do? You create a mechanism on the pole that allows the chariot to rotate about the pole while the horses are running straight.
Right.
So not to hurt the horses.
Sure.
So the horses are fine, they keep running straight, and the chariot is rolling over. So it can be done, but the ancients didn't have that device because they did not want their chariots to roll over.
How was the whole thing held together? You don't have cotter pins, do you? You don't have
nuts
and bolts.
No structural metal.
So how is it held together?
Rawhide and glue.
And what about the pole connecting to the axle, though?
The pole is first of all attached through rawhide to the front of the chariot body, and then at the back of the pole there's a socket, and the pole is at least some of them that I saw are flattened, so it goes into the socket over the axle. And it can move forth, back and forth in that socket. So that's another shock absorption. It's another spring action of the chariot body moving with respect to the axle a little bit. Now, we're talking about small motions. In a film, you wouldn't even see that kind of thing. Or even if you are riding it, you would not notice it. But it's there. A few tenths of an inch motion, that's all it takes to feel that.
So the pole isn't actually attached to the socket, it's just slotted into it?
It's slotted into it, and of course it acts like a screwdriver, so the pole with its flat end is like a screwdriver. Here I am putting my right fingers between the fingers of my other hand. It might be difficult to imagine by the radio, but this is what's happening. It can slide this way, and it can act like a screwdriver to control the axle motions.
So do we have a sense that chariot design reached a peak at some point, that there was nowhere to go with improving the technology?
Yes, I would think so. I would think so. So I think that the best chariot designs came not earlier than 1500 BC, maybe a little later. But certainly by 1400 BC, there were very good ones. And by the time of Ramses II, around 12, in the middle of the 13th century BC, there were, by the way, quite identical from what I can tell. So Ramses was about 70 years after Tut. I think that Ramses used exactly the same design chariot. Now, for some years later, that same design prevailed, I am sure. And then later on in Roman times, some of the same concepts prevailed. I think some of the socket, I see a socket in a Roman design, so and the tapered spokes on the wheels. All of these indicate that the Romans maybe even improved ever so slightly on the Egyptian design, but not a whole lot because it was already quite perfect.
What examples do we have of Roman chariots?
Well, the Roman chariots is a totally different story. There's not a good racing chariot that we can look at. There's some ceremonial chariots Even going back to Etruscan times, around 600 BC, the Monteleone chariot is a very heavy bronze prestige chariot. It's beautiful. It's at the Metropolitan Museum in New York. It's beautiful, but it would not be good for racing. It would maybe come in later than Ben-Hur, perhaps, in a race. So.
Did the Romans ever... or anyone else, for that matter, did they ever actually put rims on the wheels, you know, like iron bands?
Okay, so when we're talking about tires.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. I talk about tires quite a bit. Well, the ancients already used tires. Some used thousands of years ago. They used maybe copper tires or something like that. But they would not survive very well in history. And sometimes they used wooden tires to stiffen the outer rim. And sometimes they used rawhide bands to consolidate the wheel. So again, now the rawhide acts in a similar mode as in the joint situation, but for a different purpose. Now, the wheel, a wooden wheel that has many, many parts, is kind of flimsy. And by use, it would get loosened, and it would tend to fall apart. It's kind of a fatigue situation.
I mean, we see that.
It's like one's knee joints, you know, or shoulder joints wearing out. You know,
or even a bicycle wheel, for that matter, will do that.
Or the bicycle wheel. So the wheels would tend to wear out and fall apart. So by the Python effect, if the rawhide tire smashes down on the wheel, it consolidates the wheel. It is, of course, serving also for wear resistance a little bit, but and also for a little shock absorption. You know, it's like walking on a moccasin instead of the bare wood. But basically, its purpose is to consolidate the wheel by crunching it down into the center. Now, later, when iron tires became somewhat fashionable, although they were extremely expensive at first because there was very, very few places to get them, I think some of the earliest ones came from outer space, you know, meteors. People were picking up iron chunks.
Sure.
So how much iron can you use for racing? Not much. And, of course, it was hard to work. So expensive and hard to work and not trustworthy. You know, these ancient people didn't quite fully understand iron yet, like they understood wood. But anyway, it was a major invention to have an iron tire. And iron tires are still used in our farm vehicles. You look around any place in the U.S., you will find some iron tires. So the Romans had this question. Do I want... two iron tires on my chariot for racing purposes. It would surely be good to make sure that I arrive at the goalpost.
Right.
Okay? Mm-hmm. But it's heavier, too.
Sure.
So it doesn't accelerate as well. It sinks into the soft arena soil, so the horses are wearing out sooner. So the iron tires are not the best idea for racing, but they're safe. So the question is, do you want safety or you want to risk everything and go for the gold? By the way, the Romans didn't have, you know, third place and fourth place medals.
It was all or nothing.
It was all or nothing. Uh-huh. So coming in second would not matter very much either. There's no glory in that. So these were the two basic issues. What I found in the last couple of years from a little Roman bronze model that is now at the British Museum. I call it the Tiber model. And that's a beauty. It's the size of a hand, and it has only one horse of the two originally. And it seems to have, of course, it's all bronze, so it's conjectural a little bit, but it seems to be that only the right wheel has a tire on it.
Now, why?
So the question is, why? Well, this is like averaging your bets, in a sense. They observed that always the right wheels were ready to collapse first. or fall apart.
Because of the way the chariot turned?
Because the chariots are always running counterclockwise in a sharp paperclip type of a track. And it's similar to the Indy 500 race, although the track is different. The Indy cars run on a wider track, and the turns are not so sharp. But
right.
The chariots were in an incredibly sharp turn where you would actually slide into a turn sideways. So that would tear up your wheel, but the right wheel, because there's always a weight transfer in a sharp turn. You can feel this in your car. You know, you make a hard left turn, you are shifting in your seat to the right.
Yes.
That's what happens. So the weight transfer is to the right. This is just basic physics.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Some people would call it the centrifugal effect, you know, but that's not totally accurate. But anyway, there is a weight transfer. And the ancients, I am sure, observed that the right wheels were predominantly failing. So the sharp ones would argue that let's strengthen the right wheel, but only that right wheel. The left wheel is hardly loaded, certainly not on the turn. So the left wheel can be left weaker, and you are creating an average situation. This machine is lighter than the two-iron-tired
right.
one. It's a little heavier than the no-iron-tire one, but it has the better chance of surviving and winning. So my conjecture is that they were probably having raging arguments within the teams, you know, how many iron tires to use or none. And it's betting your life in a sense, you know. People could be killed. If the wheel falls off in a complex situation, chaotic race situation, somebody falls off and you get killed. So you're risking your life if you have no iron tires. You're risking the race if you have two iron tires.
So compromise.
Nobody is assured of winning, okay? Nobody ever. I mean, there's too many other factors involved, including the diet of the horses and of the driver, or the temperature or the moisture level or whatever. There's too many factors. But I am sure that if somebody is saying, okay, I'm willing to lose some of these bets, but over, say, a five-year period, I want to win the most gold, I would go with one iron tire just on the right side.
We'll look further at this fascinating technological innovation called the chariot when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Bela Sandor, who is a professor emeritus of engineering physics at the UW, and he has looked at this fascinating bit of technology called the chariot, as it was developed in, about 3,500 years ago or so, and years forward. The wheel, one thing we didn't mention about the wheel is we talked a little bit about the spokes, but how do they decide how many spokes to put in the wheel? What's the optimum number for that?
Well, the optimum number would be zero, of course, because that would make it the lightest. So you have to kind of keep the shape of the outer rim. And I think the first good ones of spoked wheels would have four spokes. And the Florence chariot actually is that.
That seems like it would still put an awful lot of burden on keeping that wheel round, though, with just four.
It is a little bit of a problem because when the spoke happens to be vertical under the axle, that's the stiff position. And at that point, the radius is the largest. And then it starts rolling along, and it comes into a softer part where there's no spokes.
So it kind of flattens
out a little? Then it bends a little bit, just ever so slightly. It doesn't take much to make it very uncomfortable for a human being. Just almost invisible deflection of that rim at a proper frequency as it runs would make it terrible, intolerable after a couple of minutes.
So
adding spokes is the solution. Now, how many? You know,
because you have weight to think about.
There have been some chariots like Chinese with up to more than 30 spokes. Well, that starts defeating the purpose. You know, you almost might as well have a solid wheel.
Right.
But it still looks good. It still looks elegant. But the next obvious number would be from 4 to 6. And most of the touch chariots have 6. Now, the Roman racers have 8, and some of the Roman chariot evidences have maybe 10. So 10 spokes.
That makes for a heavier wheel, though.
That makes for a heavier wheel, but for carts and wagons, you know, not necessarily for a racing chariot. But the little racing chariots would have typically 8.
And there's a lot of curved wood in a chariot. I mean, the body of the chariot was made out of wood, typically.
Yes, the chariot is mostly of wood. It's really mostly of wood. A little bit of leather, and some glue, and some rawhide.
So how did they get the necessary bends in the wood?
Well, typically you do steam bending, and the ancients already knew how to do that.
Now, you actually participated in a project a few years ago to recreate one of these chariots?
Yes. The filming was actually in the summer of 2012 in Egypt. My involvement with that project was actually about a year and a half before that because I had to educate. It was really the project for NOVA was based on my research. So I had to educate the filmmakers as to what is important and what to watch out for and be careful. And sometimes there were, you know, occasional discussions because they didn't necessarily believe that all of the little details were necessary. But the results, when they followed my advice, were very good because all of the drivers said that the ride was superb.
Well, let's start with success then.
Okay.
And the fact that you have these horses galloping 25, 26 miles an hour.
About, yes.
With this chariot, and the chariot remains stable. The driver stays in the chariot, has a great time, is able to maneuver the chariot, fairly
yes.
tight turns. How did you do it?
Well, you could not stiffen the vehicle too much. For example, the Ben-Hur chariots were out of welded steel pipe.
Oh, they were?
No.
In the movie.
In the movie. So they were very stiff. I don't think there would be a very comfortable ride. So anyway, the ancient ones, if you make the wood too thick and too heavy, like the pole itself is like a diving board. You know, it bends between the horse and the axle under the weight of the rider, which is slightly ahead of the axle. The pole bends quite a bit, several inches.
Otherwise, the horses
under the bouncing
would be
weight
miserable.
Weight of the rider of the driver. So, if you make this pole too strong, not to bend, you would lose that flexibility. If you eliminate some of the joints that are, say, good rawhide joints that allow some flexibility and replace them with firmer joints, you would lose that shock absorption also. There are other pieces of the machine, like leather traces to the yoke, that are springs, you know, a leather, it's like a leather shoelace, okay? It's that sort of thing, very, very thin but long. It keeps the yoke kind of even. So if one horse wants to run faster than the other, it evens that out.
Oh, interesting.
So these two yoke traces are springs. Now, if you replace them with wooden sticks, and some chariots have done that in the past even, then you lose that flexibility of the leather. So a leather string, and the longer it is, the more flexible it seems to be. It gives more.
So you were able to reproduce that part of these chariots. What about the wood?
The wood was very difficult to replicate. So for this Nova film, we tried to do everything as faithful as possible. And not everything was easy, but it was accomplished eventually. For one thing, the ancients used several different kinds of wood, including an elm, which is already extinct. Uh-huh. That type of an elm was long extinct before it got wiped out in this country. So you have to look for some other kind of similar wood. And basically, that was not exactly my problem, fortunately. But we had an excellent chariot maker from England, and he understood wood, and he selected typically some kind of a beech wood or oak, if necessary.
So,
but beech is a good, tough wood.
What different kinds of wood would they use for the various parts of the chariot? I mean, the demands on the body of the chariot or the demands on the pole would be very different, wouldn't they, than the demands on the wheels, which are also wood?
Yes. For example, for the spokes, you want a very tough wood. Now, elm tends to have the grains kind of interwoven a little bit. They're not just straight grains. And for that kind of a purpose, the elm is pretty good. But oak works well, too, and some kind of... oak was used for some of the... And beech. Beech was very good, a tough wood for the outer rim and also for the poles.
Any thoughts about... reproducing the original kind of horses? What sort of horses would they use for these chariots?
Well, that's a big issue because, for example, in the Ben-Hur movie, the horses were totally unrealistic because in ancient times, the horses were relatively small, typically up to shoulder height. So the withers were up to the shoulders of a human being. Kind of like a large pony,
right,
would be the proper word. So, our team, again, I was lucky I did not have to deal with that issue. But one could argue that Nova had to pay for four smallish horses in Egypt, which they owned for some time. I don't know what happened eventually. But procuring these things and the drivers and the grooms and so on is a big expense in making a documentary.
Because not just anybody can drive a chariot.
Not anybody.
Where are these chariots now that you made? You made
there
two
were
two of
them? Made. Hmm. Yeah, two were made for the Nova film. They are in this disrepair right now in storage in Egypt. And they're looking for a home. So if the UW-Madison would like to have at least one still good-looking chariot, you know, I think that might be available. But I doubt that that could be done.
Did you actually get to ride in one?
Yes.
How did that go?
Well, I didn't do much. I didn't, no.
You rode
no, not
along?
Much. No, uh-huh. I just tested the little bounce, you know. There's a woven leather platform that the driver and the rider would stand on. So that itself is a softish platform. There are some modern replications that use a kind of a plywood floor, and that's not correct. There were always some kind of leather. The Romans did also an interwoven, you know, somewhat like a beach chair.
Sure.
A beach chair kind of interwoven straps.
Well, it sounds like a fascinating experiment, one that proved a lot about ancient technology and applications of contemporary engineering physics that validate it. So thank you very much for enlightening us. Bela Sandor. has been my guest for
You're welcome.
University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland. I hope you can join me next time for University of the Air.